Welcome to the second season of Data Book. I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles, again, your co-host. Thanks for coming back, everybody. We wanted to thank all of you for returning for season two. And for everyone who listened during the break, we saw you and we appreciate it.
We did see you. And also, just a reminder, this is a healthcare analytics news podcast. And guess what? We got some changes this season. Mm-hmm. This will still be the data book that you know and undoubtedly love, but it'll only be happening once every 2 weeks. So bi-weekly. But we will also give you a lot of goods on hcanews.com. Check it out. We have a bunch of good stories there. And we promise you that this is a good thing.
So tune on in. Continue checking us out. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and review.
Just want to say a couple things. First, social media. HCA_news, healthcare analytics news, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever. You got it.
We are tweeting aggressively, people.
That's how we do it.
Come find us. Now, what's coming up also on HCA News, we just had the coolest panel in here the other day in MJH Studios.
It was awesome.
There's a group of really amazing people led by our editorial advisory board member, Kevin Campbell, MD. You've heard him on the podcast before. Really cool guy, really smart guy. He was hosting a panel of four of the biggest thought leaders in health tech here in our studios.
So one of them was Colin Hung, and he was gracious enough to stick around in the studio afterward and enter our podcast lair. So that is the conversation that we have later on in this episode after our story.
Today, we're talking about hangovers.
That's right, hangovers. The nasty feeling that you get after a pretty rough night of drinking.
Of course, that's only part of the story.
The other part of this story is Pedialyte.
That's right, we're talking Pedialyte today. It's a drink for kids who have a bad case of the flu. You probably know what we're talking about here. It's packed with electrolytes and sodium and potassium, comes in all sorts of fruity flavors and funky looking colors.
And it's all about helping kids get over dehydration. But these days, more and more adults are buying and drinking Pedialyte. Why?
Well, it's because they think that Pedialyte is going to help them overcome the horrors of their hangovers.
And that's a big departure from Pedialyte's mostly tame history. I've got to admit, you know, a salty, sweet children's drink never really struck me as fodder for a particularly interesting story.
But this is a good one, everybody. There's something really interesting about this whole Pedialyte story. It's called the Pedialyte Pivot.
So what's interesting about Pedialyte's evolution as a so-called hangover cure is how it all happened, how the customers started drinking this stuff when they were in bad shape. And then the maker of Pedialyte noticed that the customers were doing this, and the maker got right on board.
So that's the pivot, people. They actually adapted Pedialyte to serve all these new customers. And these adults were really buying a ton of this stuff. But Pedialyte didn't just get marketed to a different audience.
In several cases, the product actually changed. But still, why are we talking about this on Databook, the health tech podcast, in the very first episode of our second season, no less?
Turns out it's extremely relevant. It's all about that focus on the customer experience.
You see, right now there's a big movement in healthcare, and it is all about the patient experience.
And that basically means what patients go through when they interact with healthcare systems. That could be with physicians, nurses, administrators, insurers, really whoever.
The thing is, for a really long time, no one in healthcare bothered to consult patients. You know, they were designing the very experience that was meant to please and help and care for patients. And so this disconnect caused some problems.
So right now, healthcare is trying to bridge that gap, and that's all changing now. Patients are being brought into the decision-making process, at least a little bit. It's a slow and sort of scattered shift.
And that is why we are talking about Pedialyte, because in some weird way, it can teach healthcare quite a bit about improving the patient experience.
So this might not come as a surprise to you. The history of Pedialyte isn't exactly thoroughly documented.
What? There's no Pedialyte historian out there?
Maybe if you go to the History Channel.
If you do your homework, you will find that a doctor invented the drink, according to legend. His name? Gary Cohen. And no, that is not the same guy who calls baseball games for the Mets broadcast booth. This Gary Cohen was from a place called Swampscott, Massachusetts.
At least that's according to a book called Introduction to Clinical Pharmacology.
One of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But let's back up a step. Just to be clear, Pedialyte is not medicine. You know this already. It is a soft drink packed with fluids that are kind of supposed to replace all these minerals and things that have gone missing from the body. It's basically a less sugary version of Gatorade.
So at some point, a company called Abbott Laboratories gets its hands on Pedialyte. You know Abbott. It's been around for more than a century, and it does all sorts of stuff. I'm talking here about diagnostics, medical devices, and generic drugs, too.
And so sometime in the 1960s, Abbott begins making and selling Pedialyte. And they're selling it as the first ready-to-drink oral electrolyte solution in true healthcare terminology fashion. But it's really just for children. You know, maybe they've been throwing up or they have diarrhea and they really need a pick-me-up.
So for about the next 30 years, Abbott sticks to that plan. Pedialyte is selling, it's working, it's becoming a household name among parents. It's just this popular but kind of boring product.
Then in 1996, Pedialyte gets a little makeover. Abbott releases Pedialyte Freezer Pops, which are exactly what they sound like.
Obviously, this marketing is still aiming at kids.
And at this time, society is going through a huge change. More than a change. It's nothing short of a revolution.
The world is beginning to enter the information age. It really is starting to feel like the future. Computers and the internet are now on the rise. How we get our news and music, how we interact and communicate, it's all going through this massive revolution.
And it would have been almost impossible to know this back in the 90s, but that whole communication change, well, that was about to bring about big change for Pedialyte. Social media. Do we even need to bother with an origin story here? Something about Silicon Valley and Harvard and some guy in a hoodie?
I think our listeners' time is a little bit more valuable than that, so I'm going to say no. You guys know who the giants are here. We got our Facebooks driven by the Zuck machine. We got Twitters, Instagrams, and of course, Snapchats.
And you probably also understand the power that these platforms have, specifically this ability to amplify an idea or a trend that, you know, maybe back in the old days would have remained underground.
There's this tendency to amplify things that wouldn't typically have made the news. But at the same time, there are things that people are seriously interested in.
Like the ice bucket challenge.
Good example.
Or maybe the meme about the color of the dress.
Absolutely infuriating.
And then even something like repurposing Rickroll as a way of punking somebody.
Check. I'm never going to give you up.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Thank you.
The thing is, sometimes the stuff that's popular online also gets us to change something about our behavior, maybe even to open up our wallets.
So this phenomenon, you know, this fruit of technology, it ended up taking hold of Pedialyte.
Nobody's safe. For the record, before social media ever rocketed Pedialyte into the world of the cool, there probably were a lot of people telling their friends about this magical hangover cure.
Big quotes around that. But eventually, those conversations crept onto Twitter and wherever else. All of a sudden, around 2015, the Pedialyte secret was out.
You've got photos of celebs holding these jugs of Pedialyte, and they're popping up all over the place. Some had even posted about the drink online.
So Pharrell said it's a must for any concert rider, which are the agreements that artists make before they play a show.
A drummer named Luke Holland, he tweeted out a thank you to Travis Barker of Blink-182 for recommending Pedialyte.
And Miley Cyrus Instagrammed a photo of her holding the hangover remedy, kind of like it was some god. Send.
There's even the actor Michael Kelly. He's Doug Stamper in House of Cards. He tweeted his endorsement too.
By sometime in 2015, everybody knows about Pedialyte. Journalists start jumping on the story. Everyone from The Atlantic and The Wall Street Journal to Thrillist, they all cover it. And by the way, Thrillist wrote a great piece on Pedialyte's transformation.
So as it turns out, and it's no surprise here, sales of Pedialyte are absolutely booming at this point.
In just 3 years, between 2012 and 2015, they climbed by about 22%.
Up to about 102 million if you go by Nielsen's analysis.
So all of a sudden, Abbott Laboratories has a new market on their hands, and it has a decision to make.
Does Abbott embrace the new, provocative reputation of its longtime children's drink, or does it ignore the will of its customers?
Here, is where this story connects to healthcare and the patient experience.
When Pedialyte emerged as this answer to the hangover, its manufacturer made a few decisions that all of healthcare can learn from.
Abbott ultimately welcomed Pedialyte's new use and market. Now look, it didn't go as far as to call the drink a hangover cure because, well, there's no such thing as a hangover cure.
Wouldn't that be nice if there was, though?
Oh, God, yeah.
Anyway, Abbott did start saying, however, hey, we know a few cocktails can make you feel like crap. We know drinking can make you dehydrated. And wouldn't you know it, Pedialyte is great for helping with dehydration.
Soon enough, the company launched this whole marketing campaign. They called it See the Light, L-Y-T-E, as in Pedialyte.
It's aimed at adults this time, and it officially linked the drink to adults battling hangovers.
So Abbott begins setting up tents at big music festivals, and they're handing out free samples of Pedialyte.
Eventually, Abbott teams up with Uber and Walgreens to offer free rides home from the bar. Some passengers could even request a $5 quote-unquote fuel pack that included, you guessed it, Pedialyte.
But look, Tom, something was different about this particular Pedialyte product.
They're not just jugs of juice anymore. These are powder packs.
Powder packs. So think of the flavoring packets that you can pour into your bottle of water. You know, they make them for iced tea, energy drinks, you name it. And that is exactly what the Pedialyte powder packs are.
Now, this is where the story really gets interesting. It wasn't just that Abbott started marketing Pedialyte in this new, fancy way. That would have been smart, sure, but it wouldn't have been much of a change to their customer experience.
No. Look, Abbott went a step further. After it realized that adults were using Pedialyte to fight their hangovers, Abbott actually introduced new products for these new customers.
First, there are these powder packs, and then there are new flavors like strawberry lemonade and orange.
And they're not as sweet as typical Pedialyte flavors. So really, the big takeaway is that all of this stuff is meant for adults, not the traditional child market.
Right, it's a brand new audience. And nowadays, Pedialyte is still going strong, and it's come to adopt this new role on Twitter.
So the other day, I even heard of someone who thanked Pedialyte in a tweet for getting them through a rough hangover. And then Abbott sent them a gift bag filled with Pedialyte and branded goodies. I think maybe a beach towel, some weird stuff.
Yeah. So that's some smooth marketing right there. But the whole point of the Pedialyte story is that its maker listened to how people were using the product and ran with it.
Abbott forged a future based on the actual needs of its customers. It didn't stop at a marketing campaign. It took action, not just with its customers in mind, but with them at the forefront.
And if you talk to basically any expert out there, they'll all say that all corners of healthcare need to start doing something similar.
Are you designing an mHealth app?
Talk to patients, the customers, beforehand.
Is your health system tweaking something on the administrative side? Or maybe you're building a patient portal?
If so, it's time to bring in the patients.
Are you revolutionizing cancer care or how payers cover fancy treatments?
I'll say it again. Don't forget the patients.
Now, you get the picture. No matter how big or how small a healthcare innovation is, it will benefit from patient input.
The makers of Pedialyte did this, and the end result benefited Abbott and its customers.
Because in the end, whether it's a hangover fighter or a healthcare breakthrough, success depends on the user experience. And in healthcare, that's all about the patient. So today on Databook, we have a very special guest. His name is Colin Hung, and you have most definitely heard of him if you are in the healthcare IT scene. Colin is the chief marketing officer and editor for Healthcare Scene, and he is also the founder of Healthcare Leader. You definitely know the hashtag HCLDR. And we are so lucky that he is in person in our studio in Cranberry, New Jersey today. He was here to film a peer exchange, which you are going to love when it comes out. So Colin, thank you so much for sitting down with me and coming all the way to New Jersey from the Great White North.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun. You're right. We very rarely do this in person, so it's a privilege to be able to sit across the table from you and exchange some notes. It should be a fun discussion.
It's pretty cool. It's almost like the old radio days.
Exactly. Exactly. Almost like we should have some call-ins, you know. We'll take the next call.
Yeah. And even like a sound effects board.
That's right.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
So we're going to talk a little bit about patient experience. And I think in the community, everybody has a lot of different types of definitions, patient empowerment, patient experience. And I would just love to hear how you think of the term and what it entails. If we could start from there and then maybe dive into some of your experiences.
Sure. So I think there's a real misuse of language here where patient experience gets to be the blanket umbrella term for everything related to a patient, when in fact we have a lot of subtlety. So there's patient engagement, which is more of like, how do you engage a patient in their own health? How do you engage a patient perhaps, you know, with the healthcare system? Then we have patient access, which is just, you know, how do you get patients into the system itself? And then you have patient experience, which is the overall experience that they have with your health system. But that includes things like outcome. It includes the treatment. It's not just the fluffy stuff that people think. It's not valet parking. And, you know, it's not just those things. Beryl Institute has a really good definition, which I forget off the top of my head. But Jason Wolf and the team, they've done a really good job to define it. It's very, very specific, which I like because you don't want to have everything lumped together.
Well, it does seem like that is so common in so many different areas in this industry, too. I hear words used for other words all the time. So
yeah, and I think, you know, the patient experience space is very exciting. I mean, I've written a few blogs on this where, you know, especially at the recent HIMSS event and throughout the year, patient experience gets thrown like pixie dust on stuff. Like, it's the hot term, right? So people just sprinkle it on all their marketing materials. Oh, we do patient experience, or we impact patient experience, when in fact they really don't. Patient experience is very specific. And, you know, some of the things that are very encouraging is really more the inclusion of patients in the design of everything from physical facilities to workflow processes through to actual software. And so including that patient voice, which often does get ignored, in the design of these things is really exciting. That's only been something that's happening over the last couple of years. You know, there were some pioneering companies that were doing this a long time ago, but now we've got the formation of companies like WeGo Health. We've got Savvy Co-op. And, you know, they basically find gigs for patients to be involved in the creation of all this technology.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you've seen change? I don't know if you have an example of, hey, back in the day, patients were never involved in this part, and now they are, or they're beginning to, and we're seeing this as a result.
Yeah, sure. So back in the day when I used to be, VP of marketing, and, you know, we would get together a focus group. And so I was with a software company who was doing some stuff in the patient safety, adverse event kind of space. And, you know, we would convene a focus group. And in that focus group would be, you know, the physician, it would be the patient experience officer, it would be the at the time they were called patient relations, right? It would be those people in the room. And we'd sit around the room and go, hey, this is our new product. What do you guys think? And they give us their feedback. And then we would go and incorporate it into the product. But what was missing, of course, was the patient, you know. And now you could argue, well, why do we need a patient? It's an internal reporting tool. Like, what? Well, if you think about that space, it impacts the patient in terms of the outcome. But also, you probably want to get an eyewitness account of what happened. Did they slip and fall? Was there water on the ground or something? You want to incorporate that. We never thought about that. And so what happened was when we designed that software, it was really good for internal use. But then it started to break down at the fringes where, hey, like if you wanted to get a statement from a patient, there was no spot for that. We didn't even think of that. Fast forward to today with, you know, people like Amazon, with Apple, with all these people who have really, really pushed forward and pioneered involving consumers in the design of their products, or at least putting themselves squarely in the consumer's shoes. I think now we're starting to see that percolate into healthcare, where now we're starting to see organizations involve physicians, nurses in the design of EHRs, which is fantastic. But now on care coordination apps, on patient communication apps, we're finally seeing patients getting invited to the table, usually through advocacy groups, where they're offering their opinion, where they're offering their personal experiences to help design those interfaces and help design those workflows so it matches a chronically ill patient and it matches what an occasional patient might be like. So we're definitely seeing more inclusion of folks in the sort of design ideation phase of product design, which is a fantastic development. It's not everywhere yet, but it's definitely on the rise.
Where is it coming from? Is it coming from the way we saw Amazon and other tech companies master this? Because this is more than, this isn't necessarily a technological shift. It is a cultural shift.
It is. And I think there's a bunch of factors. I think definitely when you look at companies like an Amazon and Apple, even to a certain degree, Microsoft, you look at them and go, well, these guys have done a really amazing job designing this consumer app or consumer tool. How do they do it? Well, you know, in some cases, they got the most brilliant designers in the room and they came up with something. Well, these designers didn't design it in a vacuum. They also took the time to go and learn what their consumers wanted. So I think people are seeing the sort of positive examples going, wow, look at Apple, look at all the great things they've done. You know, maybe we should emulate that. I also think it's sort of also being spurred by the backlash. We've had a huge backlash against EHRs and going, oh, these interfaces are terrible. It's all this click, click, click. And you can tell it wasn't designed by a physician. And so I think people are going, ooh, like, don't want to be part of that. We've seen the burnout. We see the statistics. We see the hatred that some of people have for these systems. And now I think they're going, you know what? I don't want to go down that path. What can I do? Let's get these people involved up front. So I think it's a combination of the carrot and the stick. And that's driving people to use it. What I'm hoping in the next few years is that there'll be a solid ROI for that. Right now, I won't say it's fuzzy because there are some good data, but there's not enough of it. And so I'm hoping through this wave, we'll start to see, hey, look, these companies that chose to involve all stakeholders in the design process, including patients, are now actually seeing a higher return. Because guess what? Those patients talk. And when you hear that, hey, a patient was involved in the design of this product, I think patients will go, I'm more likely to want to go and buy that app, or I'm more likely to go to that doctor that has it.
Sure.
That may become a differentiator. So I'm hoping that that is really what's going to drive the industry going forward. But I think it's a little bit of fear and also you know, a desire to be like the Amazon and Apple that's driving it today.
Pardon me. What areas of healthcare do you think will be affected earliest or hardest from bringing the patients in? Is there any target that you see that is ripe for it right now?
Yeah, so there's one, the ones that are ripe for it right now where patients are getting involved is all of the interfaces with patients. So we see it a lot happen with communication tools. So what I mean by that is people who build tools that allow you to text your doctor or that allow you to book a schedule online or schedule an appointment online. So, you know, companies like Volt and companies like Well App, companies like Tiger Connect. You know, these are companies that have involved patients in the design of their products because they interact with patients. So they wanted to know, like, what are you comfortable texting back? You want to text back like a full 120 character message, or is it more like yes, no? And so they've actually asked patients to give their opinions, and they've designed their products and made suggestions so that when you implement it, it comes out of the box with certain default settings based on what patients have said. So I think those are sort of the easy ones, or those are the ones that are happening today. I think moving forward, we're going to get into more of the home monitoring stuff. So, you know, inclusion of, you know, passive monitors for falls inside the home, you know, the glucometers, all those kinds of other devices that will allow someone to age in place. I think those and those tools today is where patients are starting to get involved. We're just starting to see that momentum hit that area. So that's very exciting because, again, definitely very much needed.
So what about long-term, down the road? Like, if you could dictate the healthcare world to evolve exactly how you wish it would, what would you say in this regard?
A couple of things. If you look, there's no study, but anecdotally, if you look at the companies that have emerged today as innovators in the healthcare space, they take on of one or two types of founders. Either they're an insider that's come out and said, I can't stand it, I got to do something. Mostly physicians, right? or a very frustrated IT person in a hospital. They've decided, you know what? This is terrible. I'm going to go fix it. But it comes from that insider perspective. The other one is when it gets cooked up in, I'll call it the lab, but it's really an academic institution, right? So an academic institution looks at that and says, oh, I got an innovation arm, I'm going to come up with some new ideas. What we haven't seen is the patient-led innovation, except in the instance where someone has a horrible, horrible experience. But what about the average patient? Like, what about the average person? And we're starting to see that now, especially in the diabetic world. We're starting to see a lot of people come up with, you know, automated glucometers. We're seeing people who come up with, you know, other tools and devices that help them with their day-to-day lives. I'm hoping with more patient involvement, today that it will lead to more patient innovation tomorrow, because I think that is missing. We're not seeing the sort of patient-led innovation. And I think the maker movement is part of that. I think the big data, you know, availability is part of that. You know, all of that will lead to, I think, patient-led innovation down the road. So when you ask me, what do I see down the road? I see more that third leg coming in, not just insiders and clinicians leading the charge on innovation. It's now going to be patient-led.
It's really interesting. You know, it's almost like medicine and healthcare is kind of like a black box, like how we all talk about AI. Physicians talk about the black box of AI. It's kind of what it is for patients.
It is. Yeah. It's very opaque. I mean, you really have to be an insider, otherwise it's really hard to understand. The good news is with all of the, you know, the Fitbits of the world and the home scales and those kinds of things, we're now becoming much more health aware as a society. And as we become more health aware, I think we're going to get more actively involved in our care. And also we're going to be forced to, because we're paying for more of it ourselves. Sure. Out of pocket. So we're going to take a more invested interest in the care, what we're feeding ourselves, what we're putting in our bodies. I think that's naturally going to drive more patient involvement everywhere in healthcare. And we got to get ready. I mean, and that means getting patients involved up front in the design of your product if it touches the patient at all.
So before I let you go, do you have any stories to share with us, whether they be good or bad, about something that you saw that was really a success that changed due to a good focus on patient experience, or something that went not so good?
Well, I'll give you a couple examples of how patient innovation does not have to be sort of focus group, get them in a room and, like, you know, come up with an idea. So this came up at a conference I was at, and basically what came up was a group of patients just started using Dropbox to exchange data with their providers, because they had a lot of different care providers. So they just used Dropbox. They were techie, and they just downloaded their, you know, EHR, you know, from this person, and then put it on Dropbox, and then shared it with another person, and they just gave the password out to people. And because the patient was initiating it, there was no HIPAA issues. The doctors themselves couldn't share between them, but they could share with the patient. And so they used this rather crude way to achieve interoperability. Now, I look at that and go, everyone will go, oh my gosh, that's not scalable. It's terrible. Where's the security? Yeah. You know, what happens if, there's all these issues about why this won't work. But it was funny because one patient told another patient, and then now there's a group of, like, apparently like 10 or 15 people that are using this, and the word is spreading. I look at that and go, well, we could all sit around and wait for, like, patient involvement, but here's a bunch of patients that are doing something, and they're kind of giving, in my mind, a message to the industry going, guys, this works.
Yeah.
Why don't we adopt this? And so by involving patients can also mean just observing patient behavior. What are they using? Why are they using that as opposed to this? And then designing a better product around that that maybe is Dropbox-like in this sort of example. But I've seen that as a good one. A bad example is when I see patient tokenism. That, to me, that drives me nuts. And what I mean by that is where you invite a patient for the sake of inviting a patient, that they really don't have a seat at the table. You're just checking a box. And that's a waste of everyone's time. And so, you know, and I see that a lot, unfortunately, at conferences where they invite, like, one patient to be part of the conference when it's really just a whole bunch of, you know, X or Y specialists. Sure. And that's unfair to both the people attending and that patient. So patient tokenism is sort of when it goes bad. One personal example I had was, you know, I was involved. I was asked to be part of a product panel. I won't name the company. And when I got there, it was a patient who I knew. I was there. And, you know, this patient got a whole bunch of rules of things that they could and could not say.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they were worried that this patient would, like, take the time to, like, basically badmouth the physician and rail against pharma costs.
Sure.
And I was like, really? And no one else got it.
Well, there's no point in having the patient on.
Exactly. And this patient actually has a degree in computer science. Like, they were actually an industry savvy. So I look at that and go, okay, you're putting up all these barriers. And so that's when I see it not being done well. And now, again, thankfully that is changing. We're definitely not seeing any, you know, much more of those now. And if you are and you're listening to this, please stop that. But I definitely think, some of the positive stories is where people are just kind of open their eyes and going, wow, there's a whole resource out here that's not being used. And I just want to give a shout out to a couple of companies. I think I mentioned them when we were talking before, but we've got companies like WeGo Health. We've got Savvy Co-op out there. And these are organizations that help bring patients. If you don't know any, you can go to them and they will help find you the right kind of patients to get involved in some of the work that you're doing. And it's not expensive. And you pay and it goes into their organization, and they in turn pay the patients for their time, which is a big virtuous cycle, which I love.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Well, Colin, thank you so much again for joining me today.
Yeah, it's been great. I've loved this. We should do this more often.
Yeah, this is a quick 15 minutes.
It's a quick 15 minutes. And you know, who thought? This lovely, lovely studio here in New Jersey.
Well, thank you. Colin Hung, again, he is Chief Marketing Officer for HealthcareScene.com, and he is the founder of HCLDR, which I know you know. So, our dear listeners, thank you for tuning in to the first episode of the second season of Databook.
If you couldn't tell, we obviously put a little extra gusto into this one because these are bi-weekly now. Don't forget.
We are Healthcare Analytics News, HCA_news, bringing you what you need from the world of health tech.
If you want to help us do that, please be our guest. Hit us up. Pitch a story and let us know what you're thinking. We'd love to hear from you.
I'm at Jack Murtha on Twitter.
And I'm at Thomas_Castles.
Not Tom Castles. We recently found out that that guy has a shirtless photo as his default.
Yeah, his deltoids are really sharply defined.
That's not you.
Clearly not me.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not you. So again, thank you for tuning in. We will be back in 2 weeks. Have a good weekend.
We'll see you.